ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. For the final Ticklish Business episode of 2016, I'm sitting down with writer Nell Manow to discuss some classic films we discovered for the first time this year. Because this doesn't really require a lengthy introduction, let's get right into our discussion.
Today I'm talking with Nell Manow. Nell, how are you?
I am fine, thank you. Thanks very much for having me on the show.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I've been a movie critic for about 20 years. Started the Movie Mom website back in 1995. That was way before Yahoo, Google, or pretty much anything was on the web. And started posting my reviews then. Before that, I was the movie critic for my high school and college papers. I studied film in college, and then I went to law school, did other things for quite a long time, and got back into it when I thought it would be fun to write some movie reviews on the internet. And since then, I have been the movie critic for Yahoo for a while, and now I'm the movie critic for BeliefNet and radio stations across the country, and I've written several books about movies, too.
All the stuff that you write, it spurs me on to be better.
Oh, that's what a nice thing for you to say. Thank you. Well, apropos of our conversation today, one thing that I do is that I co-host a film series on Capitol Hill here in Washington, D.C., and we love showing the old films. We've had three different series of pre-code films and two series of Red Scare Blacklist era films.
This conversation that we're having is about classic film discoveries, stuff that we watched for the first time this year. So what were some of the qualifications for what ended up on your top three list?
I think it was probably the ones that were the most fun to talk about and maybe the ones that people might not know about. So those are the two things that I tried to keep in mind. I am the kind of person who starts off every time I turn on the television with Turner Classic Movies. I try to watch as many as I can, and I have many favorites. My first book about movies, I had about 500 old movies in there that I wrote about, and the second one had 101. I love old movies, and I love discovering new ones. Turner Classic Movies is a great resource.
Since you are the guest of honor today, why don't you start us off with what your number three classic film discovery for this year is?
Well, my number three is a film that is one of the lesser known and less appreciated films featuring Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. Now, everybody knows, of course, their classic films like Adam's Rib and Pat and Mike and even Desk Set, which is a good one for this time of year. But Keeper of the Flame is one that didn't do very well at the time. It was controversial at the time. And yet I think it has particular resonance for our current political situation and is definitely worth another look. So I was very happy to discover it and really enjoyed it. And one thing that particularly interested me is that my very favorite movie of all time is another Katharine Hepburn movie, The Philadelphia Story. And this one has the same director and the same writer and, of course, the same star. And yet it's a very, very, very different movie. We think of screenwriter Donald Ogden Stewart as being the master of glossy, sophisticated story like The Philadelphia Story or Holiday, which also starred Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant. This was the movie that he said he was the proudest of. He was a very left-wing guy. He was involved with the Communist Party. So this was the movie that was closest to his heart because it was the best reflection of his political views. So the overview of the plot is that there is a great, beloved American statesman. He's one of the most respected people in the country. Many, many people look up to him, follow him, and are guided by him when it comes to political conversations. And before the movie begins, he's killed in a terrible accident. Spencer Tracy is a reporter, and he wants very much to write the definitive biography of this man. He thinks that the best way to continue the great works, the great ideas that this man had, would be to write a book that would show how inspiring he is and how heroic he was. And so he's desperate to get the widow, played by Katharine Hepburn, to let him write this book, to give him access to the man's papers and to let him interview her. She doesn't want to see anybody. And so that's really the original premise of the film. Now, Katharine Hepburn, when this movie was made, had really just become involved with Spencer Tracy, who was, of course, married. But she had fallen in love with him, and she very, very much pushed to be put into the film. The director did not want her for it and thought that she was wrong for the part, and she was. But she wanted to be with him, and she also wanted to ramp up the romance part of the storyline between the two of them. And so that may be one of the reasons the film is a little off kilter, but it's about what happens when he finally gets her to talk and he discovers that secretly he did not believe in the things that he was so respected for, and he was plotting essentially a military takeover of the U.S.
That's one I have not seen yet. I love Adam's Rib. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, that's a classic, but yeah. There's still a few in there that I haven't seen. Death Set, I think, is okay. I don't think it's fantastic, but it's okay. I've heard good things about it because they were just getting involved in finding their chemistry together and everything.
If you're going to see another one, I would recommend Without Love. I think that's
have
another.
That, yeah.
This one is an uneven film, but it has a lot of resonance for going on in politics today. Wrote Desk Set, by the way?
Oh, gosh. I know as soon as you say it that I'm going to slap myself for not knowing. It's on the tip of my tongue.
The parents of Nora Ephron.
That's right.
Henry Ephron wrote that.
That's right. It's amazing to find out the talent just generationally in some of these classic films. My criteria for my top three was you and I both watch a lot of films. So something that sticks in the head come December is something that's got to be important. So technically I'm cheating a little bit with my number three because it was something I just watched a couple weeks ago. It is from 1955. It is the musical remake of My Sister Eileen, which the TCM Film Festival showed last year, and I didn't go, and I was really miffed because Jack Lemmon's son, Chris Lemmon, was there introducing it. The plot in a nutshell is Betty Garrett, who plays Ruth, and her sister Eileen, played by Janet Leigh. They are small-town Ohio girls who have moved to New York City to make it, essentially. Ruth wants to be a writer, Eileen wants to be an actress, and Ruth's issue is that every man who ever meets her sees her sister and then immediately dumps her. And Janet Leigh, I mean, she's beautiful, but she's not Marilyn Monroe, so go figure there. And the plot essentially is this screwball farce of them trying to get jobs, and they're living in this hovel in the basement of this house, and there's a lot of Mr. Blandings-esque issues that involve the crappy house they live in, and their neighbor is Dick York, pre-Bewitched, which is fun to see. Of course, Eileen is beating off guys with a stick, one of whom is Bob Fosse, the other is Tommy Rawl, who, if you've seen Kiss Me, Kate, has a dance in here, and he's awesome as a cad. And Jack Lemmon is the, I guess, owner of a publishing house or something similar, who wants to give Ruth a chance, but he believes that she doesn't have life experience, so she effectively takes her sister's story and commandeers it and says that it's her own life. So there's a lot of plots in this movie, and I have not seen the original, which has Rosalind Russell in it, but it's directed by Richard Quine, who was actually an actor and had starred in the original film and then transitioned into being a director for this. The screenplay is co-written by a young Blake Edwards, who would go on to direct stuff like Victor Victoria and 10, which you can kind of feel the wackiness that those movies would have in this plot. I mean, the third act involves an apartment room conga with the entire, I think, Portuguese Navy or something. How we get from A to B in this movie is very funny. I thought this was a lot of fun. The dancing's great. I mean, you have Bob Fosse in there who choreographed and dances. I don't know if he's much of an actor, but he's really good in the dance sequences. Everybody's really good. This is the first time I've seen Betty Garrett as a lead, The last time I saw her was in On the Town, where she's very much kind of a supporting player. And oddly enough, she's the horny one in that film. In this, she's like the nun, effectively. Nobody really wants her. Jack Lemmon sings, which was very odd to me, because I did not know he sang. So I had a lot of fun with this. I know a lot of people who heard that I watched this said, oh, the original is better. And I don't know, I really enjoy this, but I'm a soft touch for 1950s musicals.
Well, I completely agree with you there. Sven, I'm a soft touch for Tommy Rawl and Bob Fosse, who, of course, together were in Kiss Me, Kate.
Yes.
And Tommy Rawl was in Seven Brides for Seven Brothers as well. I'm also a huge fan of the original book, which was one of my favorites when I was growing up. It's a true story about Eileen and her sister, Ruth. And I actually have also read the biography of what happened to Eileen when she grew up. I like the first one, non-musical. And then just to be even super confusing about it, there's also a Broadway musical, which has not been filmed, with music by Leonard Bernstein called Wonderful Town, based on the same material. It's another musical, completely different songs, completely different everything. And I like it in all of its forms. I think it's a delightful story. The affection between the two sisters as they take on the world is something that is very entertaining and sort of keeps you going through slapsticky parts of it.
It's very much a gimmicky type of movie where I think if you had one bad actor in it, it would be completely terrible. But, I mean, everybody's good. The guy who plays their landlord's good. Dick York plays Meathead with a heart of gold. It's a lot of fun. So I was happy to get to see that finally before the year ends. Well, now what's your number two?
My number two, I'm a huge fan of William Castle. William Castle was more like P.T. Barnum than Steven Spielberg, even though he directed films. And even though he's associated with a very famous film, he was the producer of Rosemary's Baby and has a little cameo in it. What he's really best known for is not the quality of his films, which were pretty terrible, but of the marketing of the films. And I really enjoy the crazy stories that went into some of what he did. He had one film called Macabre, where he took out a $1 million life insurance
policy. That's right.
So that if you died of fright while you watched the movie, you would be covered. Needless to say, nobody had to pay off. He wired up theaters for The Tingler so that you would get a little electroshock while you were watching the movie.
Percepto, was that the one for 13 Ghosts where he had the ghosts actually rigged up to the top of the theater and it would fly
that
through.
That was Illusion-O.
Illusion-O, yes.
Everything had an O at the end of it. So Percepto would vibrate the seats. That
okay.
was
okay. I knew one of them.
And Emergo, they always ended with an O, was they had a real-life inflatable skeleton that would come down on a wire and it glowed in the dark.
That's right. That was for House on Haunted Hill, I think.
Illusion-O, as you said, was in 13 Ghosts, which has a special resonance for me because in my entire life, that's the only movie I ever walked out of. I was about 11 years old or 10 years old, and my mom took some of the kids from the neighborhood to the movie, and you had to put on these red and blue glasses, and if you did, you could see the ghosts, and if you didn't, you couldn't see the ghosts. At my age, I felt very strongly that that meant that they must really be there. And when they're doing the Ouija board and the Ouija board finger piece floated up in the sky and pointed at somebody, I said to my mom, I have to go home now. I've since seen the movie and I like it very much, but I think that's probably why I'm endlessly fascinated with William Castle. And so that brings me to my second film, which has the crazy title of Homicidal. So you don't get many film titles that are an adjective rather than a noun. But okay, so it's Homicidal. And this one, can I give away the surprise or not?
Oh, see, I think half the fun is the surprise, although it's really easy to tell what it is.
It is. Okay, but all right, then I won't give away the surprise. I'll just say that this is my favorite William Castle gimmick, and I'd heard about it, of course, and was really looking forward to seeing it. This is the one where he had the coward's corner. And when the main character is told not to go into the house, and then the movie just stops, and it says, okay, she's going to go into the house, and if you don't think you can handle it, you've got 45 seconds to go into the coward's corner and get your money back. And in order to get your money back, if you were crazy enough to try to do that, you had to actually sign a card which said, I am a coward. And they also had employees of the theater dress up in nurses' outfits because the idea was that there would be a nurse to help you in case you needed medical assistance because of how scary it was.
That movie is not one I discovered last year, and we won't spoil it, but it's supposedly supposed to be a precursor to a Hitchcock film.
Right.
I think that's up for debate because I think the gimmick has gotten away really easily, even to a non-discerning audience in the time it was released. But that movie is so fun. It's so fun.
It is. It is so completely wacky, over-the-top crazy that I was very, very happy to get a chance to see it.
I think Berserk is the one with Joan Crawford. I'm getting them confused. There are so many.
They're a lot alike.
My number two, we're staying in the 50s for me. I saw this and had really no idea what it was, essentially, only I knew it wasn't available on DVD. So I tend to give movies the edge in terms of taping them and actually watching them because they're not on DVD. You might not ever get a chance to see them again.
Right.
So my number two is from 1950. It's called The Second Face. It stars Ella Raines, who was a B actress, very distinctive looks, but didn't really have a huge career. She did a lot of noirs and murder mysteries. But the film is essentially, her character's name is Phyllis, so that should tell you a lot about the type of woman that she is. She's a plain Jane, and she's waiting for plastic surgery for injuries that she's had in a car accident. And the movie effectively is, oddly enough, in 1950, a feminist film about how people treat others based on their looks. Phyllis gets this opportunity to be beautiful. For half the movie, she's effectively just ignored. She's passed over for a promotion over a woman who is stupider, but she's pretty. Even though Phyllis is educated and smart, the guy that she's in love with doesn't really notice her. And she gets this opportunity to be beautiful. She's Ella Raines. She's naturally beautiful. And realizes that beauty doesn't really have all the advantages that he would want. It has a very campy ending at the end in terms of people screaming in the street and a third act twist that puts a moral on everything. But I was really surprised by how much I enjoyed this because it's a very well-developed character. It talks a lot about contemporary views of women's looks that I would never think that they would be talking about 1950, let alone in 2016. Very, very blunt. And it has a look almost like an Ida Lupino film. She dealt a lot with feminist topics that were uncomfortable. And while this is written and directed by men, it has an awareness of how women are feeling about how they're judged by society based on how they look. And it's a really interesting film. It's unfortunately not available on DVD. So if TCM shows it again, they occasionally do Ella Raines films on their schedule, you should definitely check it out because I was very surprised by how progressive the entire thing was.
That's great. I'm glad to hear it because, as you know, the 50s was probably the most retro decade of all in movies for portrayal of women.
I was very shocked because I think a lot of people see the 50s as Donna Reed and reiterating that you have to be able to vacuum in pearls, and this movie is essentially saying being beautiful is this really horrible concept that we've kind of put on our women to make them strive harder and also set them up for failure. And I was really impressed by it. Well, now what's your number one?
Well, I picked my number one because it is one of the craziest movies I've ever seen. It was another one that I had on my list for a long, long time. My daughter is a costume designer in Hollywood, and she and I have a great affection for one of the great, great, great costume designers. He didn't work in Hollywood that long because he left to go into fashion, but his name was Adrian. He did the costumes for my favorite movie, The Philadelphia Story. And I knew that I had seen in a museum exhibit a costume that he did for a movie called Madam Satan, and I just became absolutely determined that I was going to track down that movie. And indeed, we ended up showing it in that Pre-Code film series. So the Pre-Code stuff, of course, is crazy enough as it is. But even by the standards of Pre-Code, this is one of the craziest movies ever made. Cecil B. DeMille film about a woman who discovers that her husband has been having an affair. Her husband is really just a horrible guy. He and his friend go out every night, leaving her at home alone, and they're very elegant, very fancy, very sort of Depression movie era mansion that they live in, and with lots of servants. And he goes out in his, you know, elegant tuxedo every night with his friend and go to nightclubs, and they fool around with girls, and they really treat her horribly. This is pretty upsetting for her, and she goes and she confronts the mistress, who basically says, if you were delivering the goods, then he wouldn't be here with me, so the heck with you. And I think probably the first thing that would occur to any woman in that situation is to hire a dirigible, throw a fancy society party, and come yourself in disguise and try to seduce your husband on the dirigible, which then would crash.
Who wouldn't think of that?
Would be the obvious choice. And of course, the even more obvious choice is that you should have dancers dressed up as clocks do a crazy dance in the middle of all of this. It is absolutely the strangest, nuttiest, wackiest movie. I enjoyed it tremendously, and the Adrian costumes are me.
I am a big fan of the classic film costumers, you know, Adrian, Ori Kelly, Jean Louis. I mean, they're so fantastic with the outfits, and it's amazing how they actually integrate those into the narrative. I don't think we do that nearly as impeccably in modern films as we did back then.
Yeah, it is. It is absolutely. Every time you think it can't possibly get any crazier, it does. So yeah, she dresses up as Madame Satan to seduce her own husband.
Of course. Well, my number one, we're only going back a couple of years from where we started on my list, and it's another musical, but it's a musical that I has kind of become a favorite for me now. It's 1946's The Harvey Girls. I had never seen The Harvey Girls up until this year. It's directed by George Sidney, who did a lot of musicals, including my personal favorite, Bye Bye Birdie.
Love that movie.
Love that movie so much. Yes, I know it's not the same as the play. I don't care.
I don't care. It's better than the play.
Exactly.
It's much better than the
play. Thank you. I feel vindicated now. Yeah, it's amazing. It's so much fun. He also did Annie Get Your Gun, Viva Las Vegas, Anchors Away. He's kind of Mr. Musical. Judy Garland is going on the Atchison, Topeka, in the Santa Fe. She plays Susan Bradley, a mail order bride, who is going to meet a man that she's corresponded with via letters, and on the same train as a bunch of waitresses who are going to be working at a Harvey House, which was a restaurant that used to pop up along kind of whistle-stop towns as you went across America, and they offered steak and lovely ladies and big outfits and everything like that. He decides after she gets to the town and meets her intended, who they mutually agree they're not meant to be, she decides to become a waitress at the Harvey House as well. But that leads to some animosity between the clean and prim Harvey girls and the rough and tumble, colorful prostitutes who live across the way, led by Angela Lansbury in some of the best costumes ever. It's a wacky musical that is taken so serious. It's just very odd. Judy Garland at one point goes after their steaks are stolen. There's a series of pranks that they put on each other throughout the entire movie. She walks into a bar with two guns and starts waving them all around and accidentally shoots something. And knowing Judy Garland's personal life, you're thinking, who thought it was a good idea to give Judy guns in this movie? It's amazing to see, though. And Angela Lansbury just plays this cool, mean girl. Sid Charisse is there early in her career. She gets to dance a little bit. John Hodiak is the love interest, who is about as effective, I think, as Judy's love interest in Meet Me in St. Louis. And by that, I mean, he's
not
that great. Exactly. Not that great. I love this movie. I think it's so fun. The music's good. In the 1940s, where you see so many women kind of clawing to the top of whatever ladder, the end of the movie ends with nobody really changing. I mean, Angela Lansbury's character doesn't have this need to become a productive member of society, but her and Susan do kind of have this affection for each other, or at least are able to find mutual ground. It's a very nice film about the communities of women and coming together and learning to coexist, all with some amazing songs. So if you have not seen Judy Garland and the Harvey Girls, you kind of need to. It's amazing.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's an adorable movie. I mean, for me, the part that really gives me goosebumps is seeing Judy Garland and Ray Bolger reunited, because he has a part in this film. Of course, the song, Atchison, To Begin the Santa Fe, is one of the great, great songs, and I believe it won the Oscar. I don't know why Angela Lansbury so often is the bad guy, but she is. And I particularly like the poignant musical number, It's a Great Big World, as they're sort of trying to figure out what's going to happen to them and where they're going to go. But it's a lot of fun.
It's a beautiful color film as well. There's some great color cinematography in there. Listeners, you can let me know what films you discovered this year. You can email your thoughts to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and I will read them on the next episode. I would like to thank Nell once again for joining me today. Where can fans find and get in touch with you?
The easiest way to find me is at moviemom.com, and you can email me at moviemom@moviemom.com. I'd love to hear from you.
That's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. It's also going to close out Ticklish Business for 2016. I hope you've enjoyed the 15 episodes I've produced so far. Ticklish Business returns in 2017 with a host of new episodes, live audio, and exclusive interviews. Some things you can look forward to include birthday tributes to Cary Grant and Jean Harlow, and hopefully better sounding audio live from the 2017 TCM Classic Film Festival. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, or via Stitcher Radio or on iTunes. If you listen via iTunes, please feel free to leave a rating and review. As always, you can contact me at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit my official website where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also now on Twitter at ticklish_biz, where you can find out movies and other thoughts that I have. And if you enjoy my work on the show or at my website, consider supporting me on Patreon. Patrons can get access to early episodes, pick the movies or themes that we discuss on the show, even guest on a future episode. If you're interested in becoming a patron, just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Next time, I'll be joined by another guest as we honor the 77th anniversary of Gone with the Wind. Till next time, Ticklish Business wishes you a safe and happy new year.